Hi, welcome to Forensic Forecast. I'm Lee.
I'm Simon.
And it's been a couple of weeks again, which we apologise for. Last week, Simon was feeling a bit under the weather. Sadly, he has recovered now.
Well, not entirely.
But not before passing on the illness to his lovely wife.
And probably eventually to most of the people we work with.
Yeah. Thank you in advance. I could do with a few weeks off. Days.
No problem.
Days. It'd only be days.
Yeah, you're not that much of a wuss.
No. You are, but I'm not.
Yeah.
And then for the next 2 weeks, Simon's going to be away also. Where are you going to be the next 2 weeks, Simon?
I'm going to be on a course at Cranfield University, which should be good fun.
Yep, Cranfield University is the place where you want to go if you're going to do digital forensics in this country, pretty much, isn't it, Simon?
Yep, they generally put a lot of effort in, and while their techniques might not be the most up-to-date as far as some things go, they're generally in-depth enough to still be very useful.
Yeah, I mean, it's mostly the practices and the like which they teach you, which are the foundation of doing digital forensics, really. And
yeah, the techniques and the other things that you can pick up along the way. It's the getting into the right way of thinking and problem-solving modes and things like that, I suppose, that you want to establish.
Might also be a bit awkward, having not been in education for over 3 years now, going back into it.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I don't really know quite how I'll react, but we'll see.
So what is it you're going for there?
Initially it's a foundation course, but I hope to kind of build on that and get a qualification, hopefully eventually working up to a master's. But that's kind of quite a long-term thing.
Yep. Cool stuff. I went, just so you know this already, but I'm going to tell the story to everyone else. I was going to do a master's a couple of years ago, and what happened is that I went down to this university, having been accepted and everything. I was going to do a part-time master's degree, which would have taken 2 years to complete, and I travelled all the way down to this university, like 3.5 hours in the car there, 3.5 hours back, had to make arrangements to stay with somebody down there who I didn't know, and so on and so forth. Showed up to the university, and the price had, like, tripled from what someone had told me it was the year before. And they're like, oh, can you not pay for that? I'm like, well, no, hang on, let me just look in my wallet. No, I'm sorry, I don't have £12,000 in there for the first semester, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
I was a student at that university for 7 minutes before leaving.
That's, I know there's some people that we went to university with probably didn't stick around much longer than that, but that's probably a record.
Yes. The really amusing thing is that at the end of the academic year, they sent me a little sheet with all of my grades on for all the for the course that I didn't take.
Did you fail everything?
Yeah, and then at the bottom it said, if you're having problems with your course, please see one of your supervisors. And I'm like, what? I'm not there.
You should have just contacted one of the supervisors and said, I have problems with the course and that I'm not on it.
I just couldn't believe that. I won't be going back there again, I tell you. And obviously for legal reasons, I'm not going to mention which university it was. So anyway, people don't listen to us to hear all this bunkum. So let's move quickly on. Access Data, they released Forensic Toolkit version 3. Now, we heard about the preview about this a couple of weeks ago. And there's an article on the Forensic Forecast website that people can go and have a quick read of. And Access Data have also been releasing videos here and there, which people have been able to sign up to and go and watch. And if I'm being completely honest, it's not looking bad. It actually looks pretty good. And from the sounds of things, they may in this latest product release have turned to the corner.
Yeah, it seems it's they've got a whole lot of different things that they've added to this one. They've done some things that no one else has really decided to do, such as making things that have only previously been available to Enterprise Editions available to everyone, which I find quite interesting.
Yeah. One of the big things from my point of view, I think, just because we deal a lot with indecent pictures of children, is that a couple of weeks ago, Access Data announced a joint venture with LTU Technologies Image Analysis, and already it's been incorporated in FTK3.
Yeah, you got to think that they must have been working with them beforehand to get something through that quickly.
Obviously, yeah.
If not, then they're possibly the quickest programmers in the world.
But I think that's fantastic, because that particular integration goes through and potentially identifies pornographic images for review by the investigator, which is fantastic. I know there's other pieces of software which do similar kinds of stuff, but this...
A lot of the other software that does similar things, they mainly focus on the whole flesh tone idea, don't they?
Yeah.
And percentages of it. So this is a step beyond that, and it goes into just analysis of the overall picture and any possible things that might indicate that it could potentially be pornography.
Yep. So, well, we're yet to see this, but I can't wait to have a look at it and see how it works. We're going to try and get hold of a copy of FTK3 and have a bit of a play with it, and we'll report back what we find. Mm. So, but going through, I mean, they say that they've improved the FTK GUI, and they say that it's 10 times more responsive than it was before, and one of the latest videos they've put out gives a comparison and shows like a bunch of charts showing that, you know, FTK 2.2 took 6 minutes to do something, whereas in FTK 3 it took like just a few seconds. You know, they've redone the whole back end, the Oracle database, from the looks of things. They've got support for Mac now. It's just loads of stuff. So I'm pleased, because if they can get this right this time, then they're back in the game, aren't they?
Yep, undoubtedly. There are... Well, my first sort of thought about it is that it's possibly not the best time to be releasing software as far as making money goes, but if it's something that's going to improve the quality of work and it's going to make life easier for forensic examiners, then it's going to get bought and it's going to get used.
Yeah, well, if people have got maintenance agreements in place, then they're essentially going to get FTK3 anyway, I would imagine, if they're already paying the maintenance fees. So, in the long run, I mean, people aren't going to be losing out just by giving it a try. If they've already got FTK2, or, you know, FTK1 now, I guess, because of the way they handled that last time around, then... I think anyone who can should just give it a try and just see what it's like. I'm not saying that, you know, obviously without having tested it, I'm not going to say that I think it's a wonderful piece of software, because that would just be completely dishonest of me. But from the look of things, it is better. And
sometimes you can get a good idea of what a product's going to be like by seeing videos or by seeing some kind of demonstrations of it without actually seeing the finished product. The new Cellebrite bit of equipment, the physical analyzer, we're apparently amongst the first in the UK to be using that.
All right, well,
at its full capacity. All right,
we'll talk about that in a minute. Hang on. Just hold your horses a little bit.
Yeah,
honestly.
But I was going to say that that looked good, and we got it, and it actually lived up to what it looked like. So
yeah.
Sometimes things can be as good as first impressions.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Access Data, by their own admission, said that FTK2 was pretty much the Windows ME of computer forensic software. And if they can look back and they can say that themselves and say, well, and now we've got this, I think it must hold some water, this argument, that this is possibly one of the best pieces of forensic software around. But don't take our words for it. Go and test it out for yourselves. We're going to try and test it as well, and we'll let you know how that goes. So, yeah. Now, okay, I'm going to give you the opportunity now, Simon. The new Cellbrite stuff. Tell us about that.
Well, I guess the majority of people who work with phones knows that a lot of times your examination's limited to a logical extraction, which means you're going to miss anything that's deleted from a phone. But Cellbrite have been the latest one to decide they're going to go down the route of hex dumping and doing a physical analysis of phones. And they support a couple of hundred different phones now. And the tool that they have for interpreting this information is... it's probably as close as we've got so far to a tool akin to what you'd use for a kind of small-scale computer investigation. It allows you to look through the file systems in a tree kind of format. It allows you to search for things, to write scripts. It just seems to be quite useful. The only drawback at the moment, because the product's new, is that it doesn't support a massive amount of phones, but... we're promised that's going to come in the near future, really. So it does look quite good. We've done some examinations with phones, and we've found several hundred items in phones that would otherwise have not been recoverable. So it's proving quite useful.
Yep. So it's very cool. And like you said, we're one of the first people to get hold of this now, aren't we?
Yeah. We, of course, being one of the first, we had teething issues with it. It took a few weeks to get everything sorted out to the point where we could use the software fully and in the right kind of way, and we're yet to be properly trained on it as well. But we have it, and we're excited to see what we can do with it over the coming months and years. Really,
yeah, I think it's quite fantastic because I mean, like I keep saying, I'm just not a phone person at all. But this thing, when you load it up and you bring in, like, I guess, a hex dump of a phone, you open it up and it's in, like, almost like an Encase type of display, and it breaks it down very much like you would find a hard drive broken down in Encase, so, or, you know, XRY or something like that. So it's evolving, isn't it? This whole phone forensics thing is evolving quite quickly now.
Oh, definitely. It's moved on quite significantly, really, in the last year or so.
Now, I said I wasn't a phone person, but I did something this last week as well, which I think I'm going to use as a platform for maybe a couple of articles or so on Forensic Forecast. And that's... I've got a T-Mobile G1, which is a HTC Dream, the Google phone, the original Google phone. And I hacked it this last week, and I've now got complete access to the whole file system and everything on that phone. So I'm trying to figure out some certain bits and pieces, but it's quite interesting to be able to go to pick up the phone, connect it to a computer, run some commands, and essentially extract all of my saved email and text messages. And, you know, it's all the logical stuff, so it's not hugely exciting, but it's still quite exciting for someone who's not into phones that much. One of the interesting things that I found is that the last GPS location is stored as well on the phone, so I think that potentially is quite useful if you want to put somebody at a certain place at a certain time.
Yeah, it did raise a certain security concern with you as well, though, didn't it?
What was that? I can't remember now.
you know, certain things were stored in plain text somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just while playing around, I thought, oh, what's this Wi-Fi file here? Opened it up and, like, oh, yeah, there. It tells me what my home access point was, what the name of it. And then it also gave me the WPA encryption key as well, which was very kind of it to store in plain text. I guess it doesn't really matter unless someone nicks my phone and deliberately comes over to my house and tries to use my Wi-Fi. But it's still, you know...
Yeah, in the grand scheme of things, it's not that much of an issue, is it, really? No,
it's not stored...
Anyway, it's an issue if someone hacks your phone.
It's not stored in plain text on a Windows computer.
Well, no.
So, I don't see why it should be in plain text anywhere, to be perfectly honest, but... Anyway, I'm ranting, so anyway, we'll move on. Now, the IWF, I don't know how many people out there are familiar with the IWF, that's the Internet Watch Foundation. They're a British-based organisation, and they're set up by Pete Robbins, who's the chief executive, and he's a former policeman, and he retired from the police and set up this organisation, basically... To combat the growing threat of child pornography and, you know, grooming offences and all that kind of stuff which take place on the internet. Now, one of the things that they've been discussing the last few weeks, there's two things that they've been in the news for. The first one is that they are pushing to have new web filters in place. Now, what this means is that the ISPs will be responsible for getting essentially a watch list from the Internet Watch Foundation, and they'll be responsible for filtering traffic to those sites so that people cannot visit those sites. Now, that's not a bad idea. However, how are most people getting indecent pictures of children these days, Simon? Are they using websites or are they using other methods?
I would say the majority are not using websites. You do find some that use things like news groups, which could, I guess, be blocked in that sort of way. But the majority seem to be using file-sharing software.
Yeah, it's the peer-to-peer software which is the real problem. And I think that what they said was round about... 7.5% of child abuse material discovered by forensics officers came from commercial websites. So that's 7.5%. So giving these making the ISPs filter this content, you're only blocking off at the most 7.5%. Now, I don't think there's any way they're going to block all of that anyway. So if you're generous and you say 5%, it's making a difference. But you've got to wonder, is it enough of a difference? Is it worthwhile?
Well, if it's not going to be your main point of attack, if it's going to be one of several things you do, then it probably is worthwhile. But if it's your main focus, then it probably isn't, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I don't see 5%. It's such a small amount, but it depends on so many things, doesn't it? That 5%. Go on.
It depends on whether there's a sort of scale at which people migrate from one type of activity from another. If people are going to start out with an interest in these kind of things and the first thing they're going to do is looking around on the internet for websites, then they're probably not going to get to another stage of going to file sharing means.
Yeah, I can see that. Now, another thing that the article said, it's on the Register, by the way, is that almost all of the pictures which are being recovered these days are coming from peer-to-peer software. But the 7.5% that's coming from commercial websites are all the same pictures which have been floating around for several years, whereas the stuff coming through on the peer-to-peer networks is a lot of that is new stuff that we've never seen before. So that gives even more argument to the fact that blocking this small percentage, you know, it's stopping people from becoming interested, possibly, from your argument, which I can see, but it's not addressing the real issue, which is these children are being abused, and we need to be getting to the source of it. You know, people who were abused 10 or 15 years ago when these pictures are floating around, you know, from our point of view, nothing's really going to be done to save them, is there?
No.
We've got to be concentrating on the stuff which is coming through on peer-to-peer because that's the new, relevant stuff.
The thing is, there are organisations and police groups, essentially, that look at the peer-to-peer things more, the Internet Watch Foundation. If they concentrate their efforts on one thing, then they can make a difference in that one thing. If they were to spread out over several different things, they might have less of an impact. Whereas if they focus on the web side of things and left peer-to-peer file sharing mostly to other organisations, then as far as the web side of things go, they can actually put a dent in this whole child porn thing.
Yeah, I guess it's like this whole starfish analogy, isn't it? I don't know if you heard this story before, Simon, but about this boy walking along the beach, picking up starfish and throwing them back into the sea. And this guy just sits and watches him for a while, and he's like, you know, there's so many starfish on this beach. How are you going to make a difference to any of the to so many starfish? And the boy picks up one starfish and throws it into the sea and says, I made a difference to that one. And I just think, all right, that's fair enough. My personal feeling is this could be so much more effective, but if they even just manage to stop one person from being put into an abusive situation or manage to take one person out of an abusive situation, then it's worthwhile, isn't it? I guess it has to be worthwhile.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, the other thing which the IWF have been in the news about is in the UK, as we've discussed before, there are 5 different levels of indecent pictures of children. Levels 1 to 5, level 1 being the least serious, level 5 being the most serious. And level 1 is essentially, it's erotic posing, essentially, isn't it, Simon?
Yeah.
Now, the IWF have said that we don't want to really focus on these level 1 pictures anymore because a lot of them are borderline, they're open for argument, and a lot of times, that in the UK especially, you know, I mean, what kind of sentence do people get if they have a couple of hundred level 1 pictures on their computer, Simon?
I don't really know, to be honest, but it's not the greatest of sentences compared to those that are achieved for people who have more serious pictures on, I suppose.
All right, well, let's talk about jail terms then. Are you likely to experience a jail term for having only level 1 pictures on your computer?
You probably would if you had thousands and thousands of them, but...
Yeah, but...
Not if you have a handful.
There's not very many people who serve jail time for having level 1 pictures on their computer in this country. It's almost unheard of. People get put on a sex offenders register, and they'll be put on some kind of probation or counselling or something like that. And so this is one of the things which the IWF are looking at. Now, bearing in mind the IWF, they make suggestions and the like, but they have no real substantial power. but they're saying that we shouldn't be concentrating on level one pictures per se. I'm just summarizing this. It's not, yeah. Don't take what I say as complete and utter gospel. I'm just trying to summarize. They're saying that level one pictures, fair enough, if someone has them, then prosecute them, but that's not where our focus should be. Our focus should be on pictures that show the actual physical abuse of these children, and we should be doing our best to protect those children, and less so on the, you know, just the children who are posing erotically or who are nude.
Yep.
So, I don't know. I'm not sure how I necessarily feel about that.
Well, you can understand the reasoning behind that, can't you?
Well, I can, but
at the same time, it kind of blows out of the water that argument of making a difference to the one, doesn't it, really?
That exactly. It's like there's two conflicting things that they're pushing for. So I'm confused by it, to be perfectly honest. I mean, that's fair enough, right? I mean, because if you got like a load of level one pictures and say that, you know, you could quite possibly argue that these are pictures which would appear in like the next catalogue or something like that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so you got this whole debate. And then there was this whole thing in Australia a few months ago where a magazine had a picture of a naked 8-year-old on the front. And once again, you're thinking, well, that looks like an indecent picture of a child to me, based on level one. But they didn't see it that way in Australia. So they are, at best, sketchy, some of these things, aren't they?
Yeah.
And especially when you're looking at them, you think, well, Is this person under 18 or is this person older than 18? And you're gonna struggle, especially if this goes to court and these get put in front of a jury. You're gonna say, right, this girl is like 16 years old, and they're gonna say, well, you know, that girl looks like she might be 20 to me. You just don't know. But
yeah.
There's still plenty, plenty, plenty of level one pictures, which I think you could quite easily prosecute people on. I don't think that. I know it's not saying we need to ignore them, but
they say that they're still going to be doing the same things they've done before, and when people report sites with level one pictures, they're still going to take action. But what they're saying is the main focus has to be the more serious images.
Yeah. But if you get a computer which doesn't have the serious images on and only has the level one pictures on, does that person not have as much of a need to be prosecuted as the people who do have the more serious pictures on?
This isn't CEOP. This isn't a legislative body. This is a group that's doing what they can, essentially, to reduce the amount of the sharing of child pornography using the internet. And so when it comes down to our cases or whatever we do as forensic investigators, the law is still exactly the same as it was. This doesn't really have much of a bearing on what we do, per se. But I guess it's aimed at hoping to reduce the amount of cases in the future.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I would still like to hear someone discuss those two issues we've just talked about from the IWF and explain how, on one hand, they can say, you know, every child's important to us kind of thing, and then the next thing, just turn around and say, well, we need to really not focus so much on level one pictures, but go after more serious ones. I would just like to hear a rational explanation from somebody how on both of those can be correct and right. because I personally don't see it. The UN have reported that there are some 750,000 paedophiles prowling the internet. I think that is a very, very low number, if I'm completely honest.
Well, it's quite a conservative figure, but at the same time, it does say 750,000 at any one time.
Granted.
But you do wonder how, where these figures come from, really. Have they just plucked this out of the air?
I don't really know. It says that there are 4 million websites featuring minors, including those of children aged under 2 years. Now, all right, if there's 4 million websites, surely there must be more than 750,000 people. Because otherwise there's no financial gain, surely.
What's that, between 4 and 5 visitors per website?
Well, no, it's less, isn't it? Because if there's 4 million websites and there's only 750,000 on the internet at any one time.
Yeah.
You know.
Don't know where my math was there.
You were thinking the other way around.
I was, yeah.
But, yeah, and it says more than 200 new images are also circulated daily. And
I think some of these figures are quite conservative.
Well,
but they might shock some people in the general public.
Well, yeah, I mean, it probably does, and I can understand that. Now, I tell you what, if this next thing is a conservative estimate, then blimey, I'd hate to think what the real thing is. It says the production and distribution of child pornographic images rakes in between $3 and $20 billion. That's between 2 and 13 billion euros a year. That is an astonishing amount of money.
Staggering, isn't it?
Is it any wonder that these people continue to abuse children and to put these pictures and these videos on the internet? I mean, that amount of money, a lot of people would be willing to go pretty much anywhere, wouldn't they, and do anything.
Yeah, well, I'd imagine that's shared out amongst a few people.
Well, obviously it is. But if you think about it, right? 4 million websites, $20 billion.
On average, that's still fairly high, isn't it?
I was waiting for your next calculation then.
Yeah, I'm not going to go down that route again.
All right, it's a lot of money per website, needless to say. And it just boggles the mind. How, this is the other thing which makes me question the 750,000 people, because I don't think 750,000 people, I know you say it's, I know what the article says at any one time, but if you take 750,000 as a baseline figure, how are they able to generate $20 billion revenue for these websites? That's why you got to look at the 750,000 as an extremely conservative figure.
Mm.
Either that, or they're way off on the amount of money which it brings in. But it's quite amazing to me that, and I just find it terrible that people would spend money to, basically, they're contributing to this, aren't they? I always personally think that if people download the pictures off peer-to-peer networks and everything else, fair enough, right? They get arrested, they have a sentence affixed for that. But if people are paying for these things, they are actively contributing and endorsing this kind of behaviour. And so they should be given much more severe sentences.
Yeah, And then you think of the people who are actually profiteering from these things as well, and there's just a whole different level.
It's just incredible that it can be that much money. And they reckon, also this article reckons that between 10,000 and 100,000 people under the age of 18 are victims of child pornography networks. And once again, I'm not sure. I'm going to say that that's probably a conservative figure again. But I don't know. It's interesting. The bit that I found really interesting about this, and I think we talked about this earlier as well, is the last two paragraphs of this particular article.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that?
Okay. It was noted that the age of sexual consent should not be used as an excuse for child pornographic peddlers, as it is used in places where the age limit is lower than the definition of who constitutes a minor. This is because a child under 18 cannot be considered to be able to consent to sexual exploitation, including child pornography, she added. I say she, I forget who it is. I can't find a name in this article all of a sudden. Well, anyway.
Najat. Nayat or Najat Mala.
There we go, yeah. So, we were somewhat contentious as to what we thought about, certainly that last paragraph.
Yeah.
I could kind of understand some of the reasoning in that, being old enough to consent to some things doesn't mean you're old enough to consent to everything.
Yeah, well, first of all, the thing which occurs to me, right, is that I don't think that anybody ever consents to sexual exploitation, really, do they?
No.
I mean, some people argue, well, what about this, what about that? All right, fair enough. There are a few cases, but generally people do not consent to sexual exploitation anyway. But like, over here, you can legally have sex at age 16 with whoever you please. But if you have sex with a girl, for example, who is 16, and you take a picture of her while she's naked, that's still illegal. Which, to me, it doesn't make much sense. I'm not saying that they should do it or they should be entitled to do it. I just think there should be some clarification between, or you know, some association between the age of consent and the age at which somebody is considered old enough to be sexually exploited, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Well, it used to be the case, didn't it? It used to be essentially 16 for both not too many years ago.
Up until 2005, yes.
Yeah.
In this country, anyway.
So they've raised the age for 1 to 18, but left the other at 16. Mm. And I reckon if you ask the majority of people, just people out on the street, what the age was for both of these, you may be surprised to see how many people actually get the right answers. It probably wouldn't be very many.
No, indeed. Especially when you think about the whole sexting issue and stuff like that, which we've...
Yeah.
Been hearing quite a lot about recently. But I suspect that was done to bring us more in line with countries like the United States.
Yeah.
Because in order for us to work together on sexual exploitation of children, we need to obviously have certain things in place, like something as basic as the age of a child, in order for us to do these joint tasks and all that kind of stuff. But it just seems strange to me. I mean, there's countries in the world where people can be married, you know, at 12 and 13 years old, and they can be active in their sexual lives. So I just I think consent to have sex is probably almost the same thing as consenting to some of this other stuff as well. But I don't work for the UN, but I know what I see on a daily basis, and I know what you know, the general ideas of all this. I don't see where the collaboration, where the connection is between, you know, age 16 to have sex, age 18 to either watch it in this country or to be watched, essentially.
Mm. Well, we can see some ambiguity in the whole thing, can't we, in the way that IWF go about things, that we seem to almost have two conflicting things come out at once. And then you look at the actual legislation over here, and that's a little bit conflicting as well with the different ages for different things.
Yep.
And I think it just needs someone to sit down and say, this is definitely how it's going to be. This is the age for such and such a thing. It's going to be the same across the board. This is what the focus of people is going to be. This is what we're going to try and stop. But as soon as you start saying different things to different people, it could easily get kind of confusing. And yep, it seems to be quite confusing now.
Yep. All right. Well, moving on. It's not often we talk about gadgets on this show. But there was one particular thing that cropped up on Engadget last week. And I thought, wow, that potentially could cause us problems. And that is the OCZ, or OCZ, however you choose to pronounce it, PCI Express Solid State Disk Z/Z Drive. And that's shipping now. And what this is, essentially, you have a 4 500 gig SSD chips all rated together for a 2 terabyte drive that doesn't connect via the standard means. It's not IDE, it's not SATA, it's not FireWire or anything like that. It just plugs straight onto the motherboard into a PCI Express port. Now, I looked at this and I thought, this is a nightmare. Because even if you can pull that out of a system, first of all, how many people are looking for these? I can't imagine there'll be very many floating around, but is anyone looking for these devices whenever they open up a computer? Second of all, if they do happen to find one, what are you going to do with it? Because it's not a simple it's not a simple case of opening up the side of it and saying, oh, look, there's a SATA connection, because these are welded onto the board.
Yeah, they're SSD, and how on earth do you write protect a PCI Express slot?
I mean, you can get stuff like the write blocking software that I was just using the other day. What was that?
Write Block XP?
There you go. How could I forget that? So Write Block XP, I suppose, you could, in theory, use that to write block such a device. But you're not guaranteed, are you?
No.
So I just thought it was an interesting little tidbit to throw up, because
we've got to be aware of these kind of things, haven't we? I mean, data storage now can be practically anything and in any kind of situation. We were discussing this at work yesterday, in fact, weren't we, about what you would store data on, really, if you had something to hide. And I pointed out that micro SDHC cards have obviously they're not anywhere near that limit yet, but they have a theoretical limit of 2 terabytes.
Yeah.
And if anyone gets anywhere near making a card of that size, then someone knocks on your door and you've got something illegal on a memory card. What do you do? I mean, you suggested just swallowing it or something.
Yeah, I would stick it in my mouth and swallow, and then best of luck to them trying to figure out, first of all, if I'd actually done that in the first place, and second of all, getting any data out of it if they were willing to extract it from my organs.
You might be surprised, though. I mean, I've personally put a memory stick, a Sony memory stick, through a washing machine before. and it was still perfectly readable when it came out the other end.
Well, yes, but that's slightly different, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Getting something a bit wet and soapy, and then...
Yeah, let's not go too far down this line of conversation. We're going to lose listeners.
Going through stomach acids and stuff like that are two entirely different things. Yeah, I wasn't going to go any further, trust me. You're the one who said coming out the other end, so... Right. So anyway... You did, yes, we're talking about the washing machine.
Oh, yeah, well, you're just twisting my words now.
And I do it so well.
Okay. I guess the point is that if you're a first responder, you've got to check everything and wherever you go, because data can be stored on something that doesn't look like it can store data. And if you're an imaging technician, you need to check every component of anything you're asked to look at and determine. If you're not sure about something, you need to go and find out what it is, really, and just make absolutely certain you're not missing things.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It is an interesting... certainly an interesting conversation. I think it's incredible some of the things which you can save now once on just tiny little devices. I was just out at the store just a few minutes ago and saw this key ring, and I thought, oh, what's that? And looked at it, and it looks like this tiny, tiny little just nothing. But it was a 1 gig memory stick. It's about the size of your thumbnail.
Mm.
And you think, you know, would people actually think to look for something like that? And then to think that, you know, potentially you could store, you know, indecent pictures of children. And people wouldn't do it. But, for example, I could quite easily store some information on my Wii remotes and just transfer it onto there via Bluetooth.
Mm-hmm.
And that is interesting to me. But would anybody ever do it? It's unlikely, but should we know about it? Well, I think it's probably our duty to know about that, isn't it?
Yep.
So, yeah, well,
does that mean you're suggesting that all computer forensics people should be well acquainted with games consoles?
You say that mockingly, right? But I honestly really do. Ask Mark McKinnon, ask him what his thoughts are on the idea. Because he has some interesting thoughts. Speaking of Mark McKinnon, by the way. That was a nice segue. Yeah, I think I should be applauded. Guardian Digital Forensics, that's Larry Daniel, and Mark McKinnon at Red Wolf Forensics have teamed up, and they and Guardian Digital Forensics are now distributing and publishing Drive Profit. So, if you want to know more about Drive Profit, you can go to driveprofit.com, or alternatively, go back a few episodes, listen to our interview with Mark McKinnon, in which he'll explain all about it. Now, there's been some updates to things recently. Mark's always tinkering with things, and so there are more interesting bits and pieces added to the software quite frequently. So I advise people to go and have a look and see what they think. Recently... also, Drive Profit was made available to almost anybody in law enforcement, if my memory serves correct, for no additional cost.
Mm.
So that's very good of Larry and Mark to organise that. I think that's a fantastic thing. Now, I don't agree with law enforcement only stuff, and neither do any of those two gentlemen I just mentioned. But there is a need, obviously, at this time with costs and everything, putting items like this into law enforcement officers' hands is only going to have a good effect and help to reduce the amount of money spent on needless investigations in the long run.
Mm. The thing is, if you have a tool such as this, and you've got two ways you can go about distributing it, haven't you? You can either charge a fortune for it and hope a few people buy it, or you can charge less for it and hope a lot of people buy it. So the less you charge for it, I guess, the more people are going to be more likely to spend money on it, and you'll probably be better off in the long run anyway. So,
yep.
It makes sense to have a tool like this that's relatively inexpensive.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And we're going to have Mark McKinnon on again, maybe in a few weeks' time, just to talk about Drive Profit again and talk about the newest additions to the software and where he and Larry hope to take it in the future. So, yeah, we'll look forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, we move on to the interview now. Today's interview is slightly different to the norm, as in this person doesn't practice digital forensics. However, Mike Jasorka, he's a cartoonist, I don't want to say cartoons, because cartoonist might be derogatory. He's an artist, a comic book artist, and he's teamed up with a New Jersey. I'm gonna have to edit that bit. Right, I'm gonna start again. Mike Jasorka is the interview today, and many people probably don't recognise that name. And there's a reason. He's not in digital forensics per se, but he does assist in writing a very interesting weekly comic book strip called Captain Forensics. So we had an interview with him just a few days ago, and this is what he had to say. Hope you enjoy it. Okay, so this week we're joined by Mike Jasorka, the author of Captain Forensics. Did I get that right? I think it is Captain Forensics, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yep.
All right. Well, it's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
Obviously, this is a bit new for us, because usually we're asking people to be on who are hardcore computer geeks. No offense to the audience, obviously, but
I used to be myself. Don't worry.
So, I mean, it's interesting to have someone on who has kind of an outside perspective, but also does something in the forensics world. So, why don't you tell us about a little bit about who you are and what you do to start with?
Sure. I'm 24. And I currently reside in a small town called Stuartsville, New Jersey. And I grew up here in New Jersey. And I've drawn since I was about four. So I've been drawing a while. I've always had a big passion towards it. I had amazing support throughout my family. I have many musicians and artists in my family that have only embraced what I do along the way. I've recently, after college, which I studied illustration at a liberal arts college here in New Jersey called Rowan, I started embarking on a journey through self-publishing, in which I started up my own imprint called Bombshell Comics, which you can check out at bombshell-comics.com, in which you can also see all my other contract jobs, including Captain Forensics, which is for New Jersey Legal Copy, which is in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, which I produce Captain Forensics, which is about a forensic forensic analyst, and it's a blast, and I love comics, and I think I'll be doing this for the rest of my life, I hope.
Very cool. So,
yeah,
how is it that you managed to get? Well, first of all, who are you currently working for in terms of the whole Captain Forensics thing, and how did you become involved in that?
Well, Gary Overman's the president over there, and I actually worked for New Jersey Legal for a short time. I had lived in South Jersey for a couple months, and I had gotten a job in their graphic department, and I had such a great time, but I had to leave because my mother was sick, and I headed back up north where I was living with my parents, and I got a call sometime a little later after just keeping in touch with my old boss, and he said, you know, what do you think about Captain Forensics? Do you think we could do something with that? And I'm like, you want to do a comic? And he's like, yeah, let's do a comic, maybe a web comic or something, and let's make it about forensics and forensic sciences. I said, I definitely. So right there on the spot after I talked to him, I drew out what I envisioned Captain Forensics to look like as this fictional character. And interestingly enough, he got these quirks to him that make him this really great character that he's interesting in the forensics world. Along the way, we show the services that New Jersey Legal offers, and it's really a lot of fun. I write and draw it, and I have an editor. I have a few editors over there at New Jersey Legal. They all take a look at it and give me the okay. Because my spelling isn't always there, but we also work on plots and stuff together, of course, and it has been such a fun time. We really feel the industry has been reacting quite well to it, and we're happy and we're having a good time. So it's been fun.
Very cool. So whose idea was it specifically to start with then?
It was Gary's, Gary Overman, who's the president at New Jersey Legal. He's just this great guy. He used to live in California or he used to live in Hawaii, and he's always pushing the boundaries, and he's just an amazing guy to work for. I love working for them.
Captain Forensics, is he based on someone specific? Or is he like a mix of a variety of different people?
I think all of my characters initially are a lot of different people, and including myself. There's always a little aspect of myself into most of them, and that's I think most artists find themselves doing that, especially when you're writing. It's hard when you make a character and you kind of represent yourself through them or subconsciously do it. That you find yourself writing in the way that you talk and stuff. And I've done it many times with him. I can't say it's directly me though, because he's definitely himself, and that's what I've been more pushing towards. And I think most creators in comics do, is they want that character to represent themselves and their own little entity. So he's based off of no one, really. I mean, he's based off of no one and someone at the same time, and a lot of people at the same time. So, we're happy with him though. He's really fun.
So you talk a little bit about developing plots together in like the little team.
Yeah.
There. Okay. So do you want to talk a little bit more about how all that comes together then?
Yeah, sure. Sure. So I have about a 2-hour ride, down to South Jersey, to where the New Jersey Legal's offices are. And I would meet with Bob Dubord, who's more of the primary editor on this. He also updates the website and definitely has a say in a lot of the dialogue. And we all sat in a room. It was myself, Gary, and Bob, and Dave just recently. And if you go to CaptainForensics.com, the current story arc up that's called Prima Movie Collection – was one that we all formulated pretty much together, it's been going smoothly, and it's hitting everyone's vision so far. So we're really, really excited for it, and been very proud because we're on part 9 now, and it's still going quite well.
So how long has it been going for, in terms of, you know, when did it start and?
Well, it started about we're on the 22nd strip, so it's been going 22 weeks. So it's been since I guess February of this year, March of this year even.
Fun.
Oh yeah, yeah, and it was at a time of when it was great because I got this connection with the roller skating. I started up the first ever roller rink art tour, in which I made these pinups of these roller girls, all these fictional drawings of roller girls. And the niche industry that roller skating is here in the States, they react to it really positively. And they said that they love my work. And this magazine called me up and they're like, we want you to do this strip. And as soon as I said yes to that, I got this call from Gary, and it was all it felt like a little destiny, you know. It felt like, okay, this is I should strive for all this. This is really excellent, and I've been passionate about it ever since. It's been such a great time. Yeah, some of the storytelling approaches because it's such forensics is such a serious matter. We at New Jersey Legal have been striving to really keep that serious tone, but of course it's a comic strip, so we want to make it as fun as possible. So we obviously are going to stretch the limits like they do in comics, but we hope that we still bring that serious tone in with the forensics. So we had a story in particular about cyberbullying. That is something that really happens here in the States. And we wanted to keep that serious tone, but we also wanted to make it real fun. So in one particular part, the story was about how Captain Forensics was called in by this school counselor. And the counselor says that this girl's been harassed, and they believe that, you know, there's electronic evidence in the girl's cell phone in regards to a website made to mock the other girl. And you find out later that the reason why she made this site and everything was because the girl had put her backpack like in the wrong spot in the lunchroom, in which, you know, she trips on this backpack and she was embarrassed in front of the whole school because she's got all this macaroni and broccoli all over her and everything. And you know, we put those little fun, flares into the stories, but it all, you know, it comes around to a serious tone. And Captain Forensics solves the case by showing the evidence through the cell phone and using the forensic toolkit and things that I just recently have learned about. I mean, these are things that I had to be shown at New Jersey Legal and really, you know, hold them, analyze them, figure out how I'm going to draw them. Those were some of the challenges that I had to, of course, learn with all this stuff. I've only heard about forensic sciences, and I'm really fascinated by it all because it's so fresh, and yet it's right under our noses. I mean, we all use cell phones, and these things definitely do happen in corporate America. And it's amazing how it's all being implemented in the judicial system. And it's a really, really, really exciting route to take, and a really great challenge for someone that doesn't know anything about most of this stuff but is learning and is very interested in it all. And that would be me for sure. It's been fun.
I guess that it's got to be challenging to come up with new stories all the time as well, because regardless of how talented an artist you might be, if the story isn't very good, like, I can imagine if someone did a comic book of the work that I do, it'd be a case of, this is Lee, he's sitting at his desk. An hour later, he's still sitting at his desk. And it would get very, very tedious very quickly.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. And you know what? I even get panels that we've come up with that are just like Captain Forensics is at the computer, and you know he's doing this, and I have to find out a way, an angle, or whether it's a facial gesture or something that sells that panel, because the thing about comics is, it being a sequential form, you not only want to make the whole piece, the whole page, something that can be translated, but each panel has to be interesting. It has to have It has to have interest so that someone can look at it with an eye and really analyze it and hopefully get something out of even just the visuals of it all. So there's times when you have to make the boring fun and sometimes the fun has to get boring because something has to be translated and understood by the mass audience. So it's a challenge. It definitely is.
So you mentioned audience just a few moments ago as well. Now, what is the target audience for this? Are you actually looking for digital forensic investigators to read this themselves and be like, oh, this is a bit of fun? Or you mentioned the more serious tone, the underlying seriousness of the stories. Are you trying to raise awareness of digital forensics so that people understand that maybe it's not such a good idea to participate in these kinds of things? I mean, what's the whole idea, the whole purpose for it?
I think our vision, is for it all. Is to inform, to support the industry. I think, obviously, to promote our own services through New Jersey Legal, and what we could do. Even though Captain Forensics doesn't really work for us, he represents us. He is what we are, and we think he's a pretty fantastic guy, and we like to show that in our stories. But I think, yeah, overall, I mean, the audience on the web is so large. I didn't like the idea, and New Jersey Legal didn't like the idea that we'd be cutting anyone out. So we left it open for kids, and we left it open for adults, and we've been trying and striving, and we think we're doing pretty well on mixing all that and allowing all that to be universally accepted and understood and enjoyed, hopefully, you know?
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely.
So that's a challenge. It's a challenge because a lot of comics and stuff out there, they pick a specific audience, you know, whether they want the gothic crowd or they like the people that want the zombies. Zombies are huge and probably will be for a few more years now. And I think vampires are going to resurface, and these are things that we can't really necessarily go in with Captain Forensics, but we're definitely looking for ways to compete and have people subscribe and look forward to the next adventure that he'd be taking through the forensics world.
Sounds fun.
It is.
Have you had any feedback from people around the world concerning Captain Forensics, and what kind of things have you heard from people about it?
Oh yeah, actually, I got it was about 2 weeks ago. I had a request I got contacted directly, and there was a student, actually a college student, who was getting his master's, and he was doing a forensics report. And he somehow found New Jersey Legal at the Captain Forensics site. I think he was from New Jersey even, and he explained how he wanted to reference it because the cyberbullying in particular, the cyberbullying story arc that he had saw was something that he could implement into his report. And gladly we said yes, absolutely, to reference and getting that and getting him even just being interested in our strip was really excellent, because this guy was obviously getting his master's and well into his education. So I was really honored, for sure. And then, yeah, we've gotten little things even from the people that are involved in the forensics world. And all of it's been great feedback, and we've been fully embracing every bit of all that. It's really been such a fun time, and we definitely plan to keep it that way.
Do you ever get any email or messages from people saying, this happened to me, would you find this useful for creating a future comic strip for it?
No, I haven't gotten any of them, but we would love to get them. So if any listeners out there would read the strip and you see something that could be put into the strip or you have ideas yourself, we are open to hearing any compliments, and you can contact me directly through CaptainForensics.com. And I would love any feedback and any direction you think Captain Forensics would go. I'm open to it all.
So what about in the future? I mean, at the moment, are you just happy to keep him coasting where he is, or the higher, loftier things that you want to push Captain Forensics, or maybe, you know, other stuff along the same lines? You know, where do you see it going?
I think we all see it going along with the times. I think that Forensics is still, as far as I understand, it's still kind of finding itself because technology's still advancing. I think that we're gonna go along with that. We're gonna stay in tune with what's going on in the media, with Forensics even, and try to bring that into the stories that Captain Forensics could deal with. I think it only could grow in being more informative, him becoming more of a symbol through Forensics, we hope, and just continuing to tell great stories so people get excited about this new technology. And it's really, I think it's only more exciting to know that this could keep going.
All right, well, you spent a lot of time talking about Captain Forensics, so I think it's only fair that we talk about some of your other projects as well.
Okay.
So why don't you just enlighten us a little bit? You mentioned about the Roller Girl stuff.
Yeah, Roller Dames, which you can see at rollerdames.com. It's D as in dog, A-M-E-S. And I'm moving out to Los Angeles on October the 3rd, or October 5th, excuse me. And I'm really excited because I'm not only going to be going out there and furthering my career and self-employment through comics, but I think that the Roller Dames are going to hopefully find themselves, especially in this new series, Series 2, which I'm working on, will find themselves in the rinks out there in the West Coast. And I'm going to be continuing my work with Ringsider Magazine, in which I'm producing As the Wheels Turn. It's a story about a young girl and her older father who are starting up a roller rink from scratch. Really just an old market building that they found. And they're pulling their resources and they're building a roller rink with their yin and yang type of relationship. She's got the new age mentality, and he's got the old age mentality, but they're both banking on this new career together. And that's it's really been a fun time to do that one as well, because just like Captain Forensics, it's informative. We try to tailor it to rink owners and operators who maybe want to further advance their rink or bring little know-how about how to make their business better and make it smoother and you know, with that informative idea, you have a fictional story, just like Captain Forensics as well. You have this really, really sometimes what people would say to be an exaggerated story, but we always bring it back around to that, you know, that realism and then an informative side, which I think is important for comics these days, because if you look at it, a lot of school textbooks for kids, and even anyone who's eager to learn with having pictures and words you can't beat it. I mean, you're going to learn the best way that way because you're not leaving anyone out. And that's what the great thing about comics is. And something that New Jersey Legal sees too is that this is the best way to inform anyone about anything is comics. There's no doubt because it's so universal. And if you're a visual learner, you're going to pick it up. And if you just like reading, you're going to do the same. So that's the route of the informative side of my work. The fun side is all over the place. It's everything. But I just started working for Nawasha Toys, which is a small company right now. We're going to be putting out our first line of toys, in which I'm doing the comic books for. It's called Warbles. And Warbles are these warriors that are etched inside marbles. And they're really excellent. And it's a new technology, and these guys have the patent on it. And we feel like we're going to bring back this demographic of interest in marbles and the gameplay. And the story that we have going involves a planet in a distant world called Warbia. And Warbia is being polluted by the Wastoids, who are these robots that were made by Dr. Smog, and they're polluting this beautiful planet. And this boy Wally discovers the toys. He discovers the marbles, these warrior marbles, the Warbles, and actually summons back the real Warbles, the real warriors who live under the sea. And they resurface and now are going to break dance their way into ridding the planet of the Wastoids. So so if you think forensics is a little wild, I think Warbles is right up there.
That sounds a bit more complicated than forensics,
yeah,
that's for sure.
Sometimes I think that to myself too. And it's been a great ride because very exciting for me because I mean, what other project can you be doing where they're going to put out a toy line of the stuff that you're writing and drawing? It's pretty great. I'm so grateful for that and all my opportunities with all these comics.
I don't suppose we'll be seeing a Captain Forensics figurine coming out anytime soon then either.
You know what? You never know. You never know. And I am... I'm the most optimistic person you can ever talk to, and I wouldn't say no. That's for sure.
Fantastic.
But yeah, you can see the toys though at for the Warbles at ewarbles.com if you want to check that out. And soon we're going to be revamping the site in which you'll be able to read, just like Captain Forensics, the webcomic of Warbles. So. All this information on all these comics and even my independent works can all be seen at bombshell-comics.com.
Excellent. Is there anywhere else that people can follow you online? Are you on like any of the social networking?
Yeah, actually, I have a blog.
Okay.
I have a blog that I post some new works and some stuff that most people just don't see because they're either client-based commissions or something like that, in which I get their permission and I'll put them up. But you can actually go to bombshellcomics.blogspot.com. And I think I put Excellent. Up some new Roller Girls in there, and I have a billboard, a picture of a billboard I just did that is actually out in Los Angeles waiting for me. And so you could check out a lot of things on there to get more insight about what I do.
Just quickly, is that a weird feeling? If like you're driving down the road and you see a billboard which you created, that you like did the artwork for, does that just freak you out just a little bit? Or
oh, Lee,
what's your feeling for that?
Oh yeah, Lee. I mean, I was telling friends the other day when I was drawing, because I drew this billboard. But I originally drawn it at an 8-inch by 15-inch piece of paper that in my head, while I was drawing it, I knew it was going to be blown up to 8 feet by 15 feet and shown to thousands of people every day. I was the most nervous I've ever been on a drawing in years, because I think if you see my work now, I strive for being comfortable and being relaxed and showing that in the art, because it's something that definitely shows in creators. But when I drew that, I was sweating bullets, and I haven't seen it in person yet. But I saw the pictures. My girlfriend's friend had taken them for me, and I was really pleased. And I hope it's going to be out there when we fly out on October 5th.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting.
You have to tell me what it's like whenever you see it for the first time.
Oh, I absolutely will. I absolutely will. It was such a feather in my hat, and probably will ever be something to talk about if it ever comes my way or not again. That's for sure.
Yep.
And all these great opportunities. It's this business of cartooning has definitely gone. It's gone wayside for some time because of the advancements in technology. But the only industry that is still hand drawing is comics. It's the only industry everyone is still hand drawing for the most part. I mean, some people are using Wacom tablets, but my work is done with pen and ink, and in which I scan into a computer. And then I'll digitally color and digitally letter. And that's what you'll see with Captain Forensics especially.
Fun.
It is.
All right, so it comes out weekly then, Captain Forensics?
It sure does.
What day does it usually get released on?
Fridays.
Okay. Fun stuff. So everyone, if they want to catch it, they can just go to CaptainForensics.com.
Yep, and Primo Movie Collection Part 10 is going to be up really shortly.
Good stuff.
It is.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for joining us this week. It's been fun.
Absolutely, Lee. Thank you. And the podcast is great. And we're going to keep enjoying it on our end for sure.
Well, that's kind of you. All right. Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
All right. Bye for now.
Bye.
Okay. So that was our interview with Mike Jasorka. Hope you found it interesting. He's a nice guy. He was fun to talk to, and the stuff that he's doing with Captain Forensics, I think, is it's worth praise. To be honest, I think it's really an entertaining thing. I'd advise people to go check it out.
It's a bit different, isn't it, to the usual forensic ways of doing things?
Well, yeah. Now, off the interview, I did point out to him that CCL, which is a forensics subcontracting company over here in the UK, do have a comic book strip of their own called F-Man. And I pointed him in their direction. He had a look at it, and he said it was. He did actually think it was pretty good. Personally, I don't think it's as good as Captain Forensics, but, you know, it's all right. So go check that out as well. Moving on from there, Simon, have you got an interesting story to share with us this week?
Yes, it's possibly the most relevant and yet at the same time the most ridiculous of the stories that we've used at the end of the podcast. Believe it or not, the title of this one is Facebook Addicted Thief Leaves His Identity Behind. You can kind of get an idea instantly of what the story is about and how really crazy some people are. Basically, in West Virginia, someone broke into someone's home, took a couple of diamond rings while they were there, probably other things, and discovered in the owner's bedroom a computer. And this person thought to themselves while they were there, I may as well check my Facebook and just see how things are going.
Oh, no.
So, he logged into Facebook on this person's computer. I'm not exactly sure what he did, but he then left behind, leaving his Facebook page open.
Oh, He didn't sign out either.
He didn't even sign out.
Oh, what an idiot.
Yeah.
I'm glad he did, because he obviously got caught.
Yeah, this is on Ride the Lightning. They actually named the person as well. He's Pennsylvania resident Jonathan Parker. He's 19, should have probably known better. But yeah, you can imagine how the police would have reacted in showing up there, can't you? Oh, this thing's gone. Oh, what's this on the computer? Is that you? No. Ah.
Oh, I bet that was... You could imagine, can't you, that computer was taken away for analysis. And as soon as somebody looked at what happened on that computer, they were just jumping around the office going, ha ha, this is such an easy job.
Yeah. It's kind of nice to get a case like that as a forensic examiner, wouldn't it, really?
But, yeah. I wish I got some of them instead of these ones that seem to go on forever. It'd be very nice. Yeah.
But yeah, that's highly amusing. But at the same time, it's a slap in the face for intelligent people everywhere, really.
Yep. And let it be a lesson to everybody. Sign out of a computer whenever you're finished with it.
Yeah, especially if you're in someone else's house illegally at the time.
Oh, yeah. Well, not even if you're in someone's house illegally. Yeah. My brother-in-law was over here a couple of months ago and left himself logged in to Facebook on one of my computers. And I had warned people previously not to do that. And so in order to teach him a lesson, I did post on Facebook that he'd just come out of the closet. So, yeah, he didn't do it again.
I should think not.
No. All right. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of Forensic Forecast, and hopefully we'll catch you soon. Take care.
Bye.